Father John A. Hardin, S.J., is a well-known author, lecturer, and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises, and is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. The following conference is one of a series of conferences given by Father John Hardin in Oriental religions. Father has for many years studied and taught about these divergent beliefs of the peoples of the world. He is the author of the book, Religions of the World. Father Hardin first engaged in the teaching of these religions to Jesuit scholastics to prepare them for missionary work in the East. Father is a well-known authority in this field and brings out the truth and error in each belief. In the following conference, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, Hindu ritual and worship and practices. Father Hardin.
We now wish to cover the area of Hindu ritual and worship. First, I think it is well to put it into context theologically before we examine the varieties of ritual and worship. Hinduism, in common with other religions, believes that man must worship God, or the gods in whom he believes, for two reasons, both deriving from his nature. The one in terms of his having come somehow from the deity and therefore owes him recognition of his dependence, and the other in terms of his destiny, which he cannot achieve without help. There is, if you wish, a past and a future, is it to evolve in the system. The worship, therefore, is one of adoration and of gratitude, summarized in general by praise, and the Vedic hymns are full of praise, praise of Agni, of Arun, of Indra, and so on. And then prayers of petition, either to avert evil or to obtain the help that a person wants or needs, looking perhaps sometimes to the immediate future, but ultimately to the eventual future. It's at this point, and a question that I just discussed briefly before starting the lecture again came up last night, and I'd like to address myself for a moment before we examine ritual in terms of the concept of grace, which the Hindu believes in, and the word, by the way, the Sanskrit word is used and used constantly in now Christian literature for those who were Hindus or come from a Hindu culture. And the more I handle comparative religion, the more convinced I am that this is one concept which is so fundamental to man as a religious being that you cannot think or talk about man historically without including this. In fact, I would almost define religion as a recognition of man's insufficiency as a human being. Namely, he is born into the world, he has his parents, his family around him, the society in which he lives, and of course he has himself, his own faculties, yet instinctive to man as a religious being, and emphatically true of Hinduism, is the recognition that this is not enough. That both the demands made on me and for the Hindu in terms of his dharma, and the hope that he has in terms of that eventual Brahman whom he somehow is going to reach, however that's to be explained, that he cannot do either the one or the other without assistance from, shall we say, on high. Somehow outside of himself, outside of the visible empirical elements which constitute him and his society, all ritual, and Hindu ritual is no exception, is addressed besides believing that part of his destiny is tied to his worshiping Brahman, as you read about a half an hour ago, worshiping Brahman, so that he will not even be saved, whatever that saved means, unless he both worships and behaves himself morally. But that while he must do this, he cannot fulfill the precepts or the prescriptions, cannot live up to his caste system, unless he obtains help. And the help is obtained through ritual. Now, much of the ritual, in fact, practically all of it, is built into the Hindu religion in terms of dharma. And I would like to point this out because this is at least somewhat a course dealing with comparative religion and making some comparisons between here Hinduism and Christianity. To think that all ritual, not excluding the Christian ritual or liturgy, is or should be seen in terms of morality. It's not just an entity by itself. Its function is not only that vertical relationship between me and the God in whom I believe, because that can degenerate into pure ritualism, against which, incidentally, the Hindus rebelled, and against which Protestantism rebelled, one of the main reasons for the Protestant Reformation. One of the main purposes for ritual, as understood by the Hindu, is to help him keep dharma. And if for a Christian, his sacraments don't make him a better Christian, don't help him keep his dharma more faithfully, pretty soon both the dharma and, for the Christian, the sacraments will be scuttled. It's useless. If we miss that connection, the liturgy is histrionics. Pardon the parenthesis. The rites in Hinduism are varied. They vary according to caste, school, sect, and in modern times, the situations in which Hindus find themselves. And you can just imagine as we go through this, how in some cases impossibly difficult, except one or the other item, that a believing Hindu can do, can continue practicing, say, living in a country like the United States, or for that matter, in a city like Bombay or Calcutta. Yet, they are sensitive to the obligations. Since the Brahmins are the highest caste, they first of all are bound by all the prescriptions, that is, all the prescriptions of their caste, and they represent pretty much the standard of the kind of obligations that are mandatory ritually for other lesser Hindus. Consequently, for purposes of pedagogy, I will limit myself to the Brahmins. Now, first, the ritual pertains to daily practices in the home. Remember that a Brahmin, by definition, belongs to the priestly caste. Therefore, of anyone, he ought to practice the ritual. And by the way, he has a strong social consciousness in the sense that somehow his ritual practice is also of some benefit for lesser mortals. Rising before sunrise, part of his religion, a Brahmin is supposed to, first of all, avoid seeing things, and secondly, if possible, see certain things. A widow, to illustrate, a sweeper, a barren woman, are bad to see early as soon as you get up. A ring, a cow, or more tenderly, a little child, are auspicious. Again, there is a ritual way he is supposed to get out of bed. Now, afterwards, I am told, much of this becomes almost mechanical. In fact, I'm further told, too mechanical. His right foot should touch the ground first. Once out of bed, he should rinse his mouth three times and wind the thread that he gets when he reaches maturity three times around his neck and over his right ear. That's before he's dressed yet. Then after he dresses, he cleanses his teeth, rinses his mouth, again his mouth, and bows to the sun. Now, bowing to the sun and the invocation of the famous Gayatri that we talked about yesterday is so much a part of Hindu ritual that it's almost thematic all through the day. The sun plays a very important role in Hindu worship. There is a morning bath, and if there's a river nearby, which there seldom is, you should use the river. Then there are prayers to his ancestors, to various sages, our sages rather, and then the gods. There was a morning prayer, a special morning prayer, which used to finish before the sun rises. Now, I think I will quote this to you because, while, as you can see immediately, not too many can practice or even do practice this with great fidelity, or better, with perfect fidelity, I am told that no believing Brahmin will omit the whole thing, unless he's a complete apostate. After the sun rises, sitting on a low stool and facing the east, with a sacred thread over his left shoulder now, he sips water, pronounces a certain sacred formula called a mantra. And in the meantime, the pronunciation of the words from the mantra is done over ashes, which he has sprinkled, and marks his forehead, his arms, his ribs, and his knees. He sprinkles the ashes in front of him, and from them dips his thumb and rubs them on these parts of his body. At that point, he ties his hair, and closing one nostril over the other, he exhales and inhales and repeats for the first time that day the sacred invocation which we mentioned yesterday. On that desirable splendor of Savitar, who is the sun, on that splendor of the God, let us meditate. Our minds may he himself stimulate. Now, there are more such prayers. I should add that this Gayatri, ideally, and for the believing Hindu, will be done every day. It is pronounced 108 times a day. It's very short, but it takes time and it takes some attention. And if he fails to pronounce it one day, he tries to make it up the next day. And in a lifetime, it's to be pronounced, I have the figure here, 2,400,000 times. If you add it up, it amounts to about that in a long lifespan. And if he comes to the close of life and he hasn't been doing it, he starts. And if he figures that he hasn't got too long to live, he gets help. And I'm told you may sometimes see a colony, a veritable colony of Brahmins gathered around the deathbed of a dying Brahmin, desperately pronouncing the Gayatri often enough to make sure the quota is filled before the man dies. There are shorter rituals, and I could elaborate further on the morning ritual, I should say that after this early ritual is performed, there is the offering of ghee along with curd and water. So water, curd, and ghee. Now, ghee is melted butter. It's spelled G-H-E-E. I think you have it in your notes. This sacrifice, which is the most common sacrifice, ghee, by the way, is the most common, along with curd. You'll notice in both cases they are the product of the cow, who is a sacred animal, and therefore this is itself a sacred thing, and being, as you would expect, a delicacy, it therefore is that which is most precious that the Hindu has. And as I tell people when I teach about religion in general, sacrifice can be defined as the surrender of something desirable to the God in whom a person believes. It must be surrendered, must be given up, and it must be something desirable. If it isn't, it's business, not sacrifice. The essence of sacrifice is that it's something which the person likes. Sacrifice begins when the person makes an inventory of the things that he likes, and he begins surrendering them to the God in whom he believes. These sacrifices are performed each day, and this will be the private sacrifice performed by the Hindu in his own home. There are, however, shorter rituals during the day, and generally speaking, in fact, I know of no exception of any ritual performed by the believing Hindu which does not have embedded in it the pronunciation of the famous Gayatri. This 108 times, by the way, is provided for by a string of beads, which we may call, if we wish, the rosary. As you will see when we talk about the Muslims, they have a rosary of 99 beads to pronounce the 99 great attributes of Allah. Here, the Hindu has is 108 beads. There are 5 daily essentials. If I have them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yes. There are 5 daily essentials that are to be performed, and they are done at different times. The first is the so-called morning homa, which is the Sanskrit for oblation. This is that first offering of ghee, curd, and I missed it, rice. This is offered to the god Indra, the god of fire, and must precede the first meal. Before the person has sat down to a meal, he has offered food to Indra. Homa, the oblation, is followed. This is still the first one. Is followed by spiritual reading, and there is a ritual posture and so on, and the amount to be read, the sequence in which it is read, and especially what is read, are part of the prescription. The second is the ceremony of propitiation. So the first is oblation, the second is propitiation. The Sanskrit is Tarpana, spelled as it is pronounced. After sipping water, and by the way, this is always part of the ritual, the worshipper sits facing the east, as usual, again with his sacred thread, and begins pouring water through his straightened fingers. Now, without elaborating on this, the fingers are held in a certain way, and the water is poured in a certain direction of the compass. Certain words are pronounced, and there is the invocation of one's ancestors and always of the god, terminating with one's own special god. The third item on the daily program is the worship of the deity. Now, this, of course, doesn't take place all at once. The technical name for this, the worship of the deity, is the Deva Pujana. That's hyphenated, Deva Pujana. And you can see immediately, only a Brahmin could afford to do this. He usually has a small room reserved as a kind of private oratory where the image of his famous, or I should say his favorite, Ishta Devata, is reserved. He may have other gods there, but there is one that he specially worships. Moreover, in this place are kept the utensils necessary for the worship practice, such as a bell, a copper vessel, spoon, sandalwood paste for marking himself, incense, and so on. The water used for this worship must be blessed. I don't want to go into too much detail because you don't want to get lost, except to see how ritualistic this is. The blessing of water is done by the worshiper holding his right hand above the copper vessel which contains the water. He bends down his forefinger, moves the hand up and down, mentioning the names of the great pilgrimages and holy rivers, especially in the vicinity. Then he forms his hand in the form of a cow's udder over the water, symbolizing the coming of nectar. All of this done to the pronunciation of a benediction, and the water, thus blessed, is sprinkled over the utensils of the worshiper, and no utensils may be used until they have first been so blessed. There is besides the prescriptions we've already mentioned, the sacrifice which is performed at periodic times, but not necessarily every day. And although the first sacrifice that we just mentioned is performed each morning before the meal, there is a prescription for a daily sacrifice whenever a person wants something special from the gods. So the fourth would be a sacrifice which a person will perform at some other time during the day besides the morning one before his meal. And finally, there is a series of prayers said either at noon or in the evening, and ideally with all the members of the family. If all the members cannot be present, the head of the family recites them. I have here listed, from another angle, the five daily essentials: the bath, the morning prayer, sacrifice, reading, and worship. So the bath, the morning prayer, the sacrifice, reading, and worship. They, in turn, are subdivided into approximately five times a day, during the day, when these various things are done. Now, something about sacrifices over and above the daily practice, which may be once or twice a day in the home of the believing Brahmin. There are sacrifices, as you will notice, not so much from your edition, but from the previous edition that I had recommended, from the Vedas. There are great sacrifices of animals, for example. Hundreds, sometimes, it must be an exaggeration, thousands. But at least we can believe hundreds of animals at the same time, redolent of the sacrifices of the old law that we read about among the Jews. These, for all practical purposes, have been done away with. By and large, the sacrifices performed nowadays by the Hindus are replaced by the puja, that is the sacrifice, which the Hindu does in his own home and those that he does in the temple to the temple deities. However, there are certain sacrifices that are special. They're not done often, some very seldom, some only once in a lifetime. Let me just mention them. There is the Maharuda sacrifice, which is believed to wash away the sins of the person for whom it is offered, whether that person is alive or dead. Eleven Brahmins officiate as sacrifices, and they have their special names. Four more act as doorkeepers to keep the demons away. The fire lit at the beginning must burn continually for 5 or 11 days, during which the sacrifice lasts. As the name implies, the god who is invoked is Rudra. Worship is going on the whole time, and every evening there is a waving of lamps to indicate that the sacrifice is going on. A second type of sacrifice, and by the way, the sacrifice involves usually the offering of ghee, of melted butter, being thrown into the fire. The second type of sacrifice is the recitation, and by the way, I should add immediately, that sacrifice for the believing Hindu does not mean only the visible destruction of something, because it may mean, let me give it to you here, sacrifice may mean the sacrifice of something which is visible or physical, like the destruction of an animal. It can be that. And by the way, the goddesses especially are propitiated by blood. No, as far as I know, except as a rare instance, is any male god propitiated by blood, but the women goddesses or the goddesses are. So it may be that. Most commonly, the offering of ghee. It may also be, however, the feeding of animals. It may be the reading of sacred books, the pronunciation of certain prayers or invocations, or even the practice of hospitality. At any rate, the second of the great sacrifices, besides the one we've just mentioned, the first being to remove sin, this is one that is obligatory. We mentioned this before. I'll just say a more word or two about it. The sacrifice of pronouncing the Gayatri this 2.5 million times. And by the way, these figures, if they sound ridiculous to us, they are not to the believing Brahmin. If the man doubts, as we mentioned, before the end of his life that he has done this, he will get help, and they make sure that the Gayatri is pronounced. While this mantra, this invocation is said, ghee is continually poured into the fire. In preparing for class this morning, I read a quotation from an American, I think it was an American commentator, who said that on one occasion, apparently, the Brahmin hadn't been doing this for a long time, because for over a mile away, the smoke from the burning ghee could be seen coming from the temple where the melted butter was being sacrificed, while the Gayatris were being repeated day and night, and they worked it in shifts. This sacrifice, the sacrifice of the pronunciation of certain terms, is obligatory and is believed to be guaranteeing of salvation. There are finally three other great sacrifices meant to propitiate the consort, or wife if you wish, of the god Shiva. Brahmins are employed to recite a prayer, an invocation propitiating her. And this is in honor of the goddess. The simplest form of the sacrifice is to repeat the stanza, or better, to repeat the prayer, which has 700 stanzas, 100 times. The second and better form is to repeat it 1,000 times. The third and best is to repeat it 800,000 times. The cost of certain ceremonies may run into the thousands of dollars because of the number of people that have to be hired and the amount of melted butter that has to be burnt. So much for that. Temple worship is not generally liturgical in the sense of being a public ceremony. By and large, the priest alone performs either the sacrifice or invokes the prayers. The laity join by reading to themselves and by listening or hearing what the priest or priests are reciting. Some chant, some finger their gayatri beads, but otherwise they are quite separated from the liturgy itself. The innermost chamber of the temple, we're talking about temple worship now, so the first thing I think I covered was the daily practices, the second was the sacrifices, and now the temple worship. In the innermost chamber of the temple is an image of the favorite god of that caste, or a variety of favorite gods, before whom shrines are built. Usually what happens is there is one favorite god and a lot of other gods around there. The image is treated as a living being. Now, the degree to which the believing Hindu thinks that it's actually some kind of an incarnation is hard to tell. I personally believe that most Hindus don't consider it much more than symbolic, though there are those that do believe honestly that this worship actually somehow embodies the deity. One of the features of temple practice, or if you wish, of temple responsibility for the Brahmins, is to bathe the images of the gods. These images are often dressed for the day, undressed, and their clothes changed for the night, and then redressed in the morning. Meals are served by the people to these gods, and before sunset, a light refreshment, followed by a change of clothes, as I mentioned, and retirement. In the meantime, of course, the Brahmins who serve the temple consume the food. It is well to know, and is not normally found in literature about Hindu religion, that the Hindus practice phallic worship. The phallus, P-H-A-L-L-U-S, is a symbol representing the male organ of generation. This is believed to symbolize the god Shiva, who is the god of fertility. There are temples whose only image is this symbol. Again, during English colonial occupation, much has been done or had been done to improve the morality of the worship of Shiva, because recalling the kind of worship that we know the ancient Greeks and Romans practiced, the Hindus still do, among which most effective ways of propitiating Shiva is by intercourse. When I was working on the book on comparative religion, I had a section on phallic worship. One of the Jesuit censors suggested that it might be wiser to omit that section. I did.
please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.